Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
My name is Danielle Vogel, and you're listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio, a show about the little things you can do to minimize your personal carbon footprint. This show is all about empowering you to take control of the pace of environmental progress you're making just by being a little bit more mindful about the way you eat, drink, shop, think, and today especially, vote. This isn't hard stuff, but we'll show you just how easy it can be when you know exactly which small things really do matter. Today, I'm joined by Tiernan Sittenfeld, one of the very smartest people in town when it comes to thinking through innovative policy solutions to climate change. She heads up the lobby shop at the League of Conservation Voters, aka LCV, and she's been working in the climate policy world for 2 decades. Tiernan and I share the certainty that climate change is the greatest threat currently facing humanity, and we've both been working on the problem for a very long time, sometimes for the same organization, sometimes on the same legislation, but for different bosses, and sometimes across town from each other, but with the same mission in mind. Tiernan, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. On other shows, we've focused on small behavioral modifications you can make to minimize your personal carbon footprint. But today, we're going to focus on policy options and preferred outcomes. We're going to give our listeners a bit of background on what's been proposed, considered, rejected, and what may be on the horizon when it comes to finally making some progress on this critical issue at the federal level. So first, let's walk through the main policy options for addressing climate change to read folks in on the basics and give them a quick primer on the language we use in climate world. So Tiernan, I'll take some and you take some, but the idea here is that we're going to outline the main policy options for reducing global warming emissions within the energy sector primarily, and then we'll explore them a bit. So first, the very most basic, and if you wouldn't mind explaining this one, the term command and control, what does that mean with regard to limiting climate change emissions?
Sure. So I would say that that is that the government is saying, look, we have to reduce pollution, and we're going to do that using government regulations.
So historically, has command and control been used effectively to solve environmental problems?
I would say there's a lot of approaches, but not as much as not as effective as other approaches.
Yeah. And is the command and control approach politically viable in today's political environment?
Well, right now we have the most anti-environmental administration we've ever had, which the Trump administration, which is busy rolling back all kinds of common sense public health protections. The Obama administration did enact numerous great protections to fight the climate crisis, whether it was the Clean Power Plan to address pollution from power plants or the clean car standards to make cars more efficient, really popular. One of the things that the Trump administration is going after now.
The tailpipe rules.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the Obama administration used rules and regulations to great effect, but the Trump administration is, again, just awful when it comes to that.
When we have Trump antagonizing wind power because he fundamentally misunderstands
right.
it, we're probably not looking at a productive future for a command and control approach to climate change policy.
Definitely. Although we are very focused at the League of Conservation Voters in changing both the politics and the policies, so working really hard to ensure that we have a climate champion in the White House.
Certainly. All right, well, more on that
yes,
to come.
Yes, we'll come back to that.
Okay, so command and control is basically the government sets a limit on emissions and polluters are forced to comply with that limit. There's no negotiation. There's no ramp up. It is the rule and then the law of the land. So not particularly viable presently. One other policy option we hear a lot about is the carbon tax. So before we get into what the carbon tax is and how it would work, let's talk about its origin story. Tiernan, where did the idea for the carbon tax come from? Do you know?
So it was actually, I believe, a Republican concept to deal with acid rain during the Bush administration.
No. That's cap and trade. All right. So carbon tax.
Oh, right. Carbon
came
tax.
From
carbon tax.
Rex
yes.
Tillerson
right.
himself.
Yes, exactly.
Who was then the CEO of ExxonMobil.
Exactly.
In an effort to try to look productive in the climate conversation.
Yeah.
It wasn't very productive. why is that?
Well, it is interesting that there have been Republicans, and there are Republicans today who are supportive of a carbon tax. I think feeling that it's when you acknowledge the fact that we have to reduce carbon pollution, that having polluters, you know, be able to pay to pollute or to have a tax on that pollution is one of the better alternatives or less painful than some other options.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we have a lot of climate change deniers still in the Congress today who would never go for that.
Right. I mean, the word tax is difficult enough in Congress, but if it's a tax about an environmental issue, you can be pretty sure that's not going to be viable. Additionally, in order for a carbon tax to ever have, you know, even potential political viability, it would, in my opinion, have to be too low to be effective.
Right.
So it essentially just becomes a cost of doing business for the polluters as opposed to a mechanism that would change their behavior.
And some of the concerns that we have are also that some of the proponents of a carbon tax are putting it forward instead of government regulations, and that their price for admission, in fact, might be taking away EPA's authority to cut carbon pollution under the Clean Air Act. So
certainly.
For LCV, that's certainly a deal breaker. There's also a major issue of what do we do with the revenues, and are we ensuring that the communities, the frontline communities, the communities of color, low-income communities that are hurt first and worst by pollution, that are they being able to benefit and at the table in devising this when it's created?
So you actually brought up an interesting concept that I forgot that we need to talk about, which is EPA preemption. So this is a really integral part of the climate policy shaping debate. So when Tiernan said that they're trying to trade EPA's ability to enforce the rules for the carbon tax, what we're talking about is the fact that EPA currently has the right at the national level to enforce more stringent standards. And what they're trying to do in this debate would be to take away that right and allow states to pass less stringent than the federal standards on pollution, which, needless to say, would become like a political disaster, especially for lower income parts of the country, which simultaneously tend to be the parts of the country that rely more heavily on coal.
Exactly.
So not a good result. Okay, and now we'll talk about my favorite, without further ado, cap and trade. So I'll do this one. At its root, cap and trade is a free market approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Its basic elements are a cap on carbon and then a trading mechanism for polluters to come into compliance with the cap over time. So basically, stakeholders, and in this conversation, stakeholders mean people that are emitting global warming pollutants, emissions. I worked for the Bush administration, DOJ. We weren't allowed to use the word pollution. We called them emittance. So stakeholders, power plants, some manufacturers buy and sell carbon credits as they work to meet their compliance obligations. So a credit is basically it's an allowance to pollute. And so the idea is that the credits become more and more scarce, and then consequently, they become more and more expensive as the cap on pollution gets more rigorous over time. So this process gives stakeholders a running start to reduce their emissions, but ultimately results in dramatic economy-wide emissions reductions over time as emissions limits get more stringent and credits become more scarce. So it's not actually a crazy idea. Cap and trade has worked for sulfur dioxide, as you mentioned earlier, which was another pollutant that used to belch out of smokestacks. It caused acid rain. So to address the problem of acid rain, Congress implemented the first cap and trade program for sulfur dioxide, otherwise known as SO2. And voila, no more acid rain. In fact, the reductions happened faster and more economically efficiently than anticipated. And for a bit of a global reference point, both Europe and China have implemented emissions trading structures to reduce global warming emissions. In my opinion, cap and trade is the most promising, the most economically efficient, best policy option for effectively combating climate change. It creates a clear market signal that achieves a rigorous environmental result. But I left Congress 10 years ago. Can you tell us now?
Come back.
But cap and trade probably not going to be the order of the day anytime in the near future.
Well, I think we are thrilled that we have this new pro-environment, pro-climate action majority in the House of Representatives. We are so excited that Speaker Pelosi, who's the biggest environmental champion we've ever had as Speaker, that she is back and has the gavel. That is great. Mm-hmm. And the House is making a lot of progress, which I'm happy to talk about.
Yes.
But we have a Senate led by Mitch McConnell, who is a climate change denier, who just pulled an absurd political stunt on the Senate floor, bringing the Green New Deal resolution to the floor precisely because he wanted it to fail. He wanted to show a split that, as it turned out, didn't exist amongst the Democrats. And then, of course, we have, again, the most anti-environmental administration ever in the Trump administration. So we think that we need to continue to change the politics. We're not going to enact a major piece of climate legislation into law until we have a new Senate majority mm-hmm. and a new president.
Yes.
But I think for right now, the House, on both the House and the Senate side, we're seeing lots of clean energy and climate change legislation being introduced. And our feeling is let a thousand flowers bloom. This excitement, this momentum is great. And let's see what kind of progress we can make. Can we come to the table on things like an infrastructure package that is truly green mm-hmm. and climate smart?
So we'll talk about the Green New Deal in a second, but let's back it up yet again to 2009, the glory days of Danielle Vogel on Capitol Hill.
Those were the days. We miss you.
Well, those were the days because we had a chance then, right?
Right.
So there was a moment that we had passed Waxman-Markey in the House.
Yep.
We had a president who prioritized climate change. Climate change and healthcare were his top two priorities on the campaign trail. And we had a Senate that was making sort of football moves in the direction of the possibility of a bipartisan solution on climate change.
And you did a masterful job.
We did a thing back then. So we spent 2.5 years putting together this cap and trade bill. We did it with Senator, at that time, Senator Kerry from Massachusetts and Senator Graham from South Carolina. And what we were trying to do was craft a very unlikely compromise that was capable of bringing people to the table that would never otherwise have considered a progressive vote for climate change. And the way we did it was by building some unlikely alliances around provisions that were tough. But the point of doing that at the end of the day was because we were going to live and die by the cap on carbon. It was the whole thing. And in order to get that really, you know, stringently de-escalating emissions limit that I sort of described in my description of what cap and trade is, we were willing to make compromises around the perimeter. And in so doing, we were able to bring together the Chamber of Commerce, the American Petroleum Institute. I mean, people that really don't play ball on climate yeah. change. But at the end of the day, it was labeled a jobs-killing energy tax. And that was the end of it.
Yep.
And we have literally done nothing of that scope productive since. And by the way, in the meantime, during the pendency of those negotiations, we'd started with a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. We had 60. And Teddy Kennedy passed away.
Right.
And Scott Brown got elected. And simultaneously, healthcare was working its way through the Senate. And I think, oh my goodness, I don't remember right now, but there were either 6 or 8 committees of jurisdiction that each had their time like digesting the healthcare bill. And so it simply took too long yeah. from when Waxman-Markey had passed to when we had a chance to really move on our climate change bill. And so, you know, as this narrative of this jobs-killing energy tax was building, we were also losing political will. And so it died a really painful death almost exactly 10 years ago.
Yep, summer I think it was official that the plug was pulled summer of 2010.
So, I mean, maybe it was official then, but it really died the day Lindsey Graham walked out on us, which was...
It was a dark day.
It was, yeah, it was next week in 2010. It was April yeah, in 2010 yeah. when that happened. I know this. It was the week I got married.
It's a big week.
It happened on my birthday.
The best of times, the worst of times.
It was a disaster. So Tiernan, I'm going to let you like put the final nail in this coffin. I will ask you outright, any chance for a revival of cap and trade in today's Congress?
In today's Congress, meaning the 116th Congress, where we have Mitch McConnell as majority leader in the Senate? Absolutely not.
R.I.P. cap and trade. All right. So there was another proposal that we were talking about around that time called cap and dividend. Do you remember that one?
I do.
That was the Cantwell proposal. Just like broad strokes, remind us, what was cap and dividend?
That was, so it was bipartisan. It was Senator Cantwell from Washington State and Senator Collins from Maine. Mm-hmm. And that was, rather than having a trading program, it was distributing the proceeds amongst various sort of constituencies and efforts. So part of that could have gone to renewable energy. Part of that, I don't remember the exact details of where it would have gone.
So the sort of marketing contours of what they were trying to propose was that the cap and trade bill was, I'm air quoting here, like too complicated. And so what they wanted to do was introduce a much shorter bill. Their bill was 25 pages. And the punchline of it was, we're not going to give the polluters the credits. We're going to send the cash back to the American taxpayer. The problem, of course, is that climate change is an extremely complicated problem requiring a like deeply nuanced solution. So a 25-page bill was never going to get us there. And the idea of sending, you know, a $10 or $15 check to every American taxpayer was also not going to set the energy sector on the path to compliance over time. So I was extremely not a fan of cap and dividend. The only thing I liked about it was that it had Republican co-sponsorship. So we were kind of jealous about that. But policy-wise, not a good idea. All right. So then and now, because we're not seeing a lot of movement at the federal level, the state and regional initiatives are really critical. So some of the states and some collectives of states have moved forward to implement emissions reduction targets, frankly, without Congress, because who has the time to wait? So Tiernan, can you tell us what's happening on the state and regional level that's been effective?
Absolutely. The state progress is so exciting. And I mean, it's absolutely horrifying what the Trump administration has done. And of course, we're coming up on the 2-year anniversary of Trump deciding to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. But the pushback...
Happy Earth Day, one
yes,
all.
Right, exactly. but the pushback from other countries, from states, from cities, from businesses who are saying, we are still in, we are still going to reduce our pollution, and we're going to do that while improving and building our economy and creating the clean energy jobs that we so desperately need. That is all moving ahead. And actually, LCV was proud to work with our 30 state LCV partners to launch a campaign called Clean Energy for All, with a goal of getting to 100% clean energy and pollution-free communities no later than 2050. So we launched that about a year ago. We're
awesome.
Really thrilled. It was our first ever conservation voter movement network-wide campaign. And we were delighted that, as it turned out on Election Day, we were asking candidates on the campaign trail, will you commit to 100% clean energy? More than 600 candidates up and down the ballot who had made that commitment won their elections on Election Day, including 10 new governors.
Building an army.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Which is really great. So we now have these 10 new governors in states all across the country who are making good on that progress. So former Congresswoman Michelle Lujan Grisham from New Mexico is now Governor Lujan Grisham. The New Mexico state legislature has already passed, and she has signed into law a bill to get New Mexico to 100% carbon-free energy by 2045.
That's incredible. I mean, I usually just think of like REGI, which is the Northeast Collective, and what's happening in California.
No, it's
We've got
it's happening
New Mexico
in
these
states
in the right direction?
All across the
Heck
country.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. We're seeing progress in the Nevada legislature, and we have a great new clean energy champion, Governor Sisolak, in Nevada. Back to the New England, the new governor of Maine, Janet Mills, is very focused on progress. We have in the Midwest, we have great new governors in Wisconsin and in Michigan who are intent on moving to really building their clean energy economy and see that it's good for creating jobs. It's ultimately going to help consumers with their energy bills. And, of course, it's good for the planet, good for our national security. I mean, it's just win, win, win all around. So we're really excited about that. And, in fact, close by in Maryland, the legislature just passed a renewable electricity standard bill. And I believe that will make it the 8th state that is on track to be at 50% clean energy by 2030. So there is real progress in states all across
awesome.
The country.
All right, so that's another important term, RES or RPS. So there's a renewable energy standard, there's a renewable portfolio standard. But what this means is you're looking across the generation resources to make sure that we have a preference for clean, sustainable energy.
Yep.
That's what that means. So that either, you know, some high percentage of all power generated within the state needs to be generated using clean energy solutions.
Well, I should also add, we're seeing mayors across the country. I just was talking with the mayor of St. Petersburg, Florida, which, of course, Florida is being really devastated by the impacts of climate change, but also seeing the benefits of moving to a clean energy economy. And there are Republican mayors like in Carmel, Indiana, and Georgetown, Texas, who aren't necessarily talking about climate change day in and day out, but they are seeing the benefits of transitioning to clean energy and what that does for their economy.
So another throwback, because God forbid, we should leave 2009 for more than 5 minutes. The last words that Speaker Pelosi shared with the chamber before they voted on Waxman-Markey were jobs, 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 jobs. And what she was promising was that if we could incite a transition to a clean energy future, there would be major economic upsides for America. Sounds like she was right.
She was absolutely right. In 2017, there were 3.2 million Americans working in the clean energy sector. It's more than triple the number of people employed in fossil fuel jobs. So absolutely, we are seeing huge benefits. And the clean energy sector, wind, renewable efficiency continues to go gangbuster as fossil fuel jobs continue to fall. We are, of course, I should note, very focused on how do we provide a just transition, especially for mine workers. Nobody should be left behind in the clean energy economy. And we need to be able to ensure that this transition includes good family-sustaining jobs for everyone.
Critical. I mean, critical to political viability, but critical to the future of the American economy as well.
Absolutely.
And wouldn't it be sweet if we could actually manufacture the technologies we'd invented instead of having to buy them from other countries?
Yep.
So we're talking with Tiernan Sittenfeld. She's the Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at LCV. Now for the big question, the Green New Deal. Tell us, how is the Green New Deal going to help climate change specifically?
So we are really excited about the Green New Deal. We support the Green New Deal. We absolutely applaud Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, and Senator Markey, who we mentioned earlier, from Massachusetts, for their leadership. And the attention that the Green New Deal has helped bring to the climate crisis is really amazing. And I think it's partly people, unfortunately, all across the country and across the world, the devastating impacts of climate change are really hitting home, and they are happening much quicker and more severely than had even been predicted, whether it's, you know, the devastating hurricanes up and down the East Coast, the flooding that has just been hitting the Midwest, the deadliest forest fire ever in California's history. So I think a combination of seeing the deadly and devastating impacts of climate change, also seeing, you know, just the costs of inaction, and then the upside of the clean energy economy for job creation. And then we have this great new Congress with AOC is great, but there are people like Mike Levin, who is in California's 49th district. He ran for Congress, decided to run after President Trump got elected, in part because the person who was in that seat before, Daryl Issa, was terrible when it came to clean energy and climate change. And
terrible.
He showed up at an event of his. Mike Levin showed up at an Issa event, giving him a book about climate solutions. So he's now in Congress. Or we have Sean Casten from Illinois, who's a longtime clean energy entrepreneur. There are all these veterans who understand firsthand the impact between climate security and national security.
Yes.
There are longtime environmental justice advocates. There are people who had expertise and experience as state legislators or working in state government who have brought that to Congress. So there is a real opportunity for the House to move forward and to show what's possible, even if we're not going to be enacting it into law. So with the Green New Deal, I think it's a huge opportunity. I think AOC and Senator Markey put it out as here's a resolution, and this is a starting point. And I think there's a lot of hard work, important work to be done to hash out how do we make the incredibly important aspirational goals of the Green New Deal, how do we make that a reality?
So I know we're still in negotiation phase, despite the shenanigans on the floor with McConnell.
I think that really backfired for him. I mean, and he ultimately, even himself, had to acknowledge for the first time publicly, I think, that climate change is happening and that human activity is playing a role.
Which, you know, small wins, right?
Baby steps. Super baby.
But what sort of specifically relevant to climate change, what is the New Deal going to do? Are we talking mostly about mitigation, transportation improvements? My expertise is in energy sector reform. that does not seem to be the focus of this proposal.
Well, I would say the centerpiece is the transition to 100% renewable energy.
Okay.
In, you know, in 10 years from enactment, at least that's sort of the ambitious.
Yeah.
But I would say now is the time to challenge ourselves to be as ambitious as we possibly can to shoot for the moon. And I think one of the things that's exciting and that sort of clearly this is something that has resonated with the American people. And we've done polling both on the popularity of 100% clean energy and the Green New Deal. And both are extremely popular. We actually did this in early presidential primary states. And it is on par in terms of what a priority it is with healthcare. It's a very top priority for Democratic voters. But we've seen in other polling across demographics, people want to transition to 100% clean renewable energy as fast as we possibly can.
Certainly.
And I think that the Green New Deal speaks to both the enormity of the problem and the opportunity to truly transform our economy as we deal with this existential threat of climate change.
So are we essentially talking about a national RPS?
Potentially. Again, I would say there's sort of the broad contours, and now there's the work to be done. And, you know, we talked about a carbon tax. We talked about cap and trade. Mm-hmm. I think, could those be part of it? Are those sort of complementary? I think that's a lot of the work that needs to be.
That will get me back to Capitol Hill, I swear to God. Somebody else is going to take over Glenn's Garden Market. If cap and trade becomes viable, I am back.
Danielle.
I am back in a heartbeat.
Wow, awesome.
If I don't leave to join the Inslee campaign. So let's talk about that for a second.
Yep.
Jay Inslee has joined the race. He is a Democrat running for president, and he's doing so with climate change as the cornerstone of his candidacy. What say you?
I say good for Governor Inslee. It is great to have someone in the race who is running specifically because he is so concerned about the climate crisis, because he sees that this is the defining issue of our time, that this is a chance to enact solutions that are going to really bring about the just transition to a clean energy future that we need. We at LCV are extremely focused on helping to create a race to the top when it comes to climate change. Mm-hmm. And Governor Inslee has set an extremely high bar. I will say it's really encouraging that all of the senators who are running for president thus far are all supporting the Green New Deal. If we think back to 2016, which is traumatic to do for all kinds of reasons, but during the general debate, during the general election, there was not one climate change question asked by the moderators during the debates. So that is unacceptable. Now we see candidates going out of their way to bring up climate change at every opportunity. For many of them, it's been part of their announcement videos. They're talking about it regularly on the stump. So we're encouraged by the attention, which is just a sea change from last time. It's still very early. I mean, mm-hmm. It's, you know, April of 2019. But what we'll be looking to see is how much are candidates prioritizing climate change relative to other issues? How much are they starting to put out detailed plans for what they intend to do should she or he become president, starting on day one in the Oval Office?
So obviously we're talking about Jay Inslee specifically. Which other candidates should we follow in terms of like potential climate heroes?
Well, I would say you should follow all of them, and we should insist that anyone who is serious about running for president needs to make climate change an absolute top tier priority. So when people are going to events, if they happen to get called by these candidates, if they see them online, on social media, they should be asking, what is your plan to reassert international leadership for the United States when it comes to combating the climate crisis? What is your plan to work with Congress starting on day one using all the levers of government? What are you going to do to have 100% clean energy economy-wide? And also, I think we need to hear from people personally, why is this issue so important? Mm-hmm. This is not some distant threat. This is our reality today. And we need to understand why it is so motivating to people who are running for president.
So the importance of showing up and asking those questions really can't be overstated. In fact, that is how John McCain became a climate champion. There was somebody who would dress up in this climate or Captain Planet costume and show up at the front line of all of his rallies and scream and yell about climate change. And it was an issue on which McCain wasn't particularly active or educated prior. It was while he was running for president one of those few times. And he comes back to his office and he says, you know, what is this climate change issue? And who is this Captain Planet guy? And he ends up learning more and more about climate. And the thing about climate is the more you learn, the more outraged you become.
Yep.
And he ended up becoming a, you know, national standard bearer in the quest to enact meaningful climate change reform. because somebody showed up at a rally and made him do it.
Exactly.
So listen to what Tiernan is saying. Show up at the rally and make them do it.
And I wish that we had more Republicans in the Congress today, like John McCain, who really led on climate change. We need to get
you
back
and me
to
both,
that point.
Sister. Okay, so we're talking with Tiernan Sittenfeld of the League of Conservation Voters about options for legislative progress on climate change. We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we'll get some tips on impacting the climate debate. Back in a sec. Welcome back. This is Everyday Enviro, a show about the small things you can do to reduce your personal carbon footprint. I'm Danielle Vogel, founder of Glens Garden Market, and I'm joined today by Tiernan Sittenfeld of the League of Conservation Voters. We've been talking climate policy options, including the carbon tax, cap and trade, and the climate-relevant portions of the proposed Green New Deal. Now we're going to give you some tips about how you can make a difference when it comes to shaping the national debate on climate change. Okay. So we've learned a little bit about the policy options and learned a little bit about who the congressional champions and climate deniers are. But how do we get involved? Tiernan. Yes, exactly. What do we do? Show up at rallies is the tip we got earlier. What else?
Definitely show up at rallies. Definitely write letters to your members of Congress, to your state legislators, to your members of city council. Show up in their offices. Absolutely write letters to the editor. I years ago heard a member of Congress say when he saw letters to the editor on a particular issue in his hometown newspaper, he knew that that meant that so many more of his constituents actually really cared about that issue. So on one hand, it sounds a little bit old school, but I think still letters to the editor are absolutely important. Even just if you can't show up in person or you can't send a letter, just making a phone call if your member of Congress or your other elected official does something that you like, give them a pat on the back. If they do something you don't like, definitely let them know. At LCV, we support environmental candidates through a program called Give Green, where if candidates really meet our very high standards of demonstrating that they care deeply about environmental issues, especially climate change, that they are not going to just be a good vote, but they're really going to wake up each and every day thinking, what can they do to be part of the solution on that day? So we help those candidates have the resources that they need to win by having regular people be able to make a contribution through Give Green. So helping candidates have the resources that they need to win and making clear that you are contributing to those candidates because you care about the environment and you expect them to also is really important. Certainly, as the 2020 presidential is a real opportunity to continue to elevate these issues. As I was just saying before, we're so glad that it's such a different world from 2016 where issues matter and where climate change is one of the issues that is really getting a lot of attention. But we can't take anything for granted. We need to continue to ensure that it's a top priority. So again, showing up at issues, making the phone calls, calling into talk radio, those are all hugely important.
And then also on an even more personal level, you can make climate change a key voting issue for yourself.
Absolutely.
When you're assessing the candidates for president all the way down to freaking ANC.
Definitely.
Make it matter to you and make it matter to them by extension.
And I should note, we put out a national environmental scorecard, and many of our state conservation voter partners put out scorecards at the state level. So before you go to the ballot box, which absolutely is the fundamental right that we all need to participate in to help shape who's representing us and make sure that they're good on climate change and other issues. But we are in real time on our website, lcv.org, but also each year we put out a scorecard that evaluates how members of Congress vote on the key issues of that given congressional session.
And we usually talk about small behavioral modifications, but here's a really big one. If you care deeply about the future of climate change policy, go get a job on Capitol Hill or for one of the agencies or for one of the advocacy groups. Tiernan and I both did it. We've committed our lives to it. It's pretty fun.
and in fact, run for office yourself.
Heck, I think
one of the most thrilling parts of being up on Capitol Hill these days is this new class of House of Representatives. Not only are they incredible on issues like climate change, 56 of them supported 100% clean energy on the campaign trail. They're
just
now
for a
in
moment,
office.
When the Tea Party thing happened to America,
in 2010,
we elected on the same day 80 climate deniers.
Right.
So we are moving quickly in the right direction at last.
It's such a sea change. But these people, they look more like the rest of America. There are more women, more people of color, more firsts, more young people. I believe that this new class dropped the average age in the House by 10 years. So just to have this new energy and this diversity in all ways is so exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think absolutely everyone who's listening, people should consider running for office themselves. Don't wait for someone to ask you.
All right. And when you're ready to announce, you can come on Everyday Enviro and we'll amplify your good work.
Definitely.
So, Tiernan, any last thoughts on how folks can affect meaningful progress on climate issues before it's too late?
Well, I think it's everything that you talk about every week in terms of the choices that people make on their own is super important. I say that as a vegetarian. But I do think we need to, in addition, we absolutely need to enact systemic change. And to do that, we need to elect the right people to office. We need to have environmental champions up and down the ballot who are not going to be beholden to big oil and dirty coal. Mm-hmm. They are going to be representing their constituencies, and they are going to stand up for our future, because as we're seeing from the devastating impacts, like we have very little time to wait. So I think the things that we've been talking about in terms of voting, in terms of committing to only support candidates who are going to be strong on these issues, I can't say enough how important that is.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Thank you so much for being here today, Tiernan. I learned a ton, and I'm feeling even more empowered to activate. Before we end our time together, though, let's take a moment to reflect on why climate change is a problem worth even attempting to address at the personal level. It's huge and complex, and at times it seems well beyond our control, but it's not. This is your moment of motivation. Guys, usually I take a few moments here to read a few like activating statistics or share some facts about the impacts of maybe packaging waste or water consumption to create agriculture. But I'm going to speak directly from the heart this time, so stick with me for a moment on the soapbox. So Congress hasn't considered a meaningful measure to substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions since 2009. It's been a freaking decade. In the last 2 years, agency action has been aggressively stifled, and we've weaseled out of our international climate commitments as well. We had an opportunity to lead, and now we're the lead obstructionist. On the most pressing issue facing humanity, our government has decided to oscillate between doing nothing and doing harm. I started a climate change-obsessed grocery store about it. What are you going to do? Thank you for listening to Everyday Enviro on Full Service Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.